All right, so good evening. This is the second of two talks about two suttas that have a wide application but address some very foundational and fundamental aspects of practice, and I'm framing this in the sense of looking at these suttas as a way of dealing with strong emotions, fear, anger, resentment, lust, with, you know, whatever you want to put on the list, and we'll use pain as an illustration. So there's two suttas. The sutta regarding Monk Kayaputta, who was a senior monk of the original historical Sangha, and it's a dialogue between the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and him. Some of you I know have read the sutta. And the other one is called the Kuma Sutta, or the Tortoise Sutta. And the tortoise was the nickname of a junior monk in the historical Sangha. Does anybody believe that? That part's not true. But the sutta is called the Kuma Sutta, or the Tortoise Sutta. And as I said last time, it's not to be confused with like Aesop's fable, where there's, you know, the hare and the tortoise. It's a different story, and this is the jackal and the tortoise, and we'll talk about what that means. Yeah, I know that there's a number of people here who weren't here last time, and a couple of newcomers, and because I think that at least the foundational part of this last talk is important, I'm going to kind of go over that. And I think, as everybody knows, you know, you can hear this many times, and maybe you don't hear it until the 10th time, you know. And so I want to start again with this story, because if you don't remember anything else, you remember this little story. And it's kind of a pivotal story, and there's a lot of different versions, but basically this version is that there's two monks from different monasteries, different sanghas, who meet each other on a riverbank, and they start talking about their two different sanghas. And eventually the topic gets to, well, tell me about the abbot, you know, of your sangha. And so the first monk becomes very, very effusive, and he says, well, you know, the abbot, my teacher. You can tell that this monk had a lot of spiritual pride from his report. And he says, well, you know, my teacher, I mean, like, he is really amazing. He can recollect all of his prior lives. He can meet people, and he knows when they're going to die, and he knows all of their prior lives. He can read people's minds. He can see into the future. He can create another body that allows him to be in two places at the same time. And actually, that's what was happening. I was on the train coming back from San Jose, and my second body just hadn't gotten in there in time for the sitting. But and then the last thing he says, well, he can make his body so light, he can walk on water. You know, so that's a fairly impressive lineup of qualities, you know. And so, and he kind of says it like, well, you know, try to beat that, you know, to the other monk. And the other monk says, well, yeah, my abbot's pretty incredible too. And my abbot, when he sees, he just sees. And when he hears, he just hears. And when he smells, he just smells. And when he touches, he just touches. And when he has a thought in his mind, he has only that thought. And each one of those things, he has one at a time and doesn't move to the next one until that one's done. So that's basically the message of this first sutta, which is actually a fairly long sutta, about the senior monk. And the reason this is important is this has a lot of import, and it illustrates how understanding the context of how basic teachings fit together in a web. So much of the Buddha's teachings had to do with distinguishing his teachings from what immediately preceded them, what the dominant themes were in spiritual life and spiritual teachings. And prior to the Buddha's arrival, and while he was there, the predominant spiritual religious tradition was the Vedic tradition. Their Hinduism did not yet exist. And there is this fantastic history of the Upanishads and other teachings which eventually became codified. And many of those you can read, and they are exquisite in their description of mind states and their deconstruction of mind states, much in the way that we do it and we teach it and the Buddha taught it. Among other things, one of the huge distinctions and what this is in part about is that the Vedic tradition, its notion of consciousness was that there was a consciousness that arose outside of us, that it was a consciousness that was part of, although a disembodied, being or presence, and that our consciousness arose from that consciousness, and the purpose of practice was eventually for those two consciousnesses to merge into one. So the situs of power was outside of the individual, in the same way that the vehicle for awakening was outside of the individual, because the Vedic tradition had all of the power for spiritual progress invested in the priesthood, who did ceremonies and sacrifices, and almost all of those were done in secret. So it's not like you'd show up in church and you'd go to mass or a ceremony. You would pay the Vedic priests, and they would do these rites and rituals. That may sound familiar, right? It's one of the attachments that, it's part where that comes from. And then they would do these rituals largely in secret, and they would speak in a secret language. It was a disempowering spiritual tradition. You know, you could have all this awareness about your mind states and everything, but ultimately your spiritual progress was not in your own hands, the ultimate spiritual progress. So the Buddha came along and said, rejected that completely, and said there is nothing outside of us that our spiritual progress is based on our own intention and our own effort in conjunction with others, but not in the sense of there being some spiritual being or a larger disembodied presence. And what this sutta is about is how consciousness arises from a Buddhist perspective. And the historical Buddha's position was, it is not that there is a unified consciousness, as meaning that when I am conscious, there is this single unified perception that is like the basis of Western psychology. In Buddhism, there is a consciousness that arises in relationship to each sense door. So the one monk saying, you know, the thing that's so incredible about my abbot is that when he sees, he sees. When he hears. What's not said is that he knows that. He knows the difference between I'm seeing and I'm hearing and I'm feeling and I'm thinking, as opposed to what happens to us a lot, where all of those things just collapse in on each other all at once. We make no distinction. We have a reaction to it, we attach and we identify, and we're off to the races. Okay? So one of the significances of that simple little story, and then as the Buddha lays this out in the sutta, is the knowledge, the actual knowing of what's arising when it's arising, and that a consciousness arises when a sense door, one of our senses, connects with the object that is related to that sense door. So my eye sees one of you, and sight consciousness arises. And then my eye recognizes, you know, there's a recognition process that takes place, a perception that, though I know it's Margaret, or I don't know who that is in the back, I've never seen them before. But before any of that can happen, this sight consciousness arises or sound consciousness arises. Okay? Working so far? And this is a huge distinction, you know, between what preceded and what existed, and actually almost every other spiritual tradition. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So the Buddha was saying that consciousness itself is this unbelievably dynamic human thing that's arising and passing away every time you look at something, every time we hear something, every time we feel something. Okay? And if we can begin seeing that point of a connection when things arise, that our perception of who we are and the world around us and how we understand experience begins to slowly change. And I think I mentioned last time that I go to shopping malls and it drives me crazy. So I've never been very good to accompany someone to a shopping mall, and if I have to, what I normally do is I'll just pick out some part of the mall and sit down, and then I'll just pick out like 10 or 12 feet and I'll just look there, okay? And then I just watch what happens when people walk by, you know? And it's great because I've gotten to the stage of practice where I don't have to be humiliated about all the thoughts that come up. You know, because you're just sitting here and, you know, your mind's like kind of clear, and, you know, and somebody walks by and, you know, there's this moment of contact, and your mind just immediately goes, wow, can you believe how sloppy that person is? You know, and, you know, just... Well, can't they stop eating, for Christ's sakes? And, you know, just all of these things that unfold, you know, wow, she's really attractive. Or, boy, I like those shoes, you know. And you just start to see, because you know, the focus is not following anybody, right? That this idea that consciousness arises at the moment of connection, you begin to see it very, very clearly, you know. So one of the exercises I like to recommend, like on one days and on retreats, is, well, go out and see if that's true. And just walk out and walk up to something and look at it, and look at it as you've never seen it before. What happens? And almost invariably, people come back and report that all kinds of things happen that they didn't realize normally was happening, and that it brings the energy up in the body. You know, when you begin to see this, you see the dynamic nature of it, and rather than resisting it, you start to fall into it, and it actually brings your energy level up. It can be a very exciting thing. So the analogy that I was trying to use last time is that you can call this moment of contact whatever you want to call it. You can call it a moment of contact. You can call it the moment that consciousness arises. You can call it the moment of, you know, original experience, whatever it is. But the analogy is at that moment when there's that contact, it's like, boom, there's this canvas that's there. And then almost immediately, something gets thrown up on that canvas. And so if you can even a little bit start getting a taste of this, of, you know, when I hear something, I can, you know, I can see going this way, or I pull back, you know, when I see a particular person, you know, my energy moves towards them, it moves. You start to first of all be able to see that there's a canvas and there's something that appears on the canvas, and then you start to be able to distinguish the consciousness itself from what's arising in a consciousness. Okay. Well, this is an exciting moment, because normally these two are just collapsing together. And we have an emotion, and we think it's like, it's my emotion, and I get upset, you know, about the emotion, or I get upset because I'm having the emotion. But if we can back this up and be watching for that, it's like, boom, there it is. It opens up. And then you can start to distinguish between consciousness and thought, or consciousness and emotion, or consciousness and feeling. And then you start to see that they are distinct and separate things, and they are arising and passing away. You know, we always hear that, but that's how it happens. That's the progression, okay? So that's the precursor. So the sutta starts, and what frequently happens in the suttas is there is a discussion going on between the Buddha and someone who's being a foil to the Buddha. He's not challenging it. There's some suttas where there's kind of this argument going on, but this is one of the ones where the senior monk is being a foil. Okay, so the Buddha starts off, and he's obviously trying to make a point, and he, as you know, he's very systematic. So he says to the monk, "Okay, well, let's start with eye consciousness. Okay, if you have take anything that the eye might recognize, you know, so let's say it's some kind of a flower." And you have never seen that particular kind of flower. Never seen it before. Is there any kind of consciousness arising, eye consciousness arising about that flower? And the senior monk says, "Surely not." He doesn't say no, he just says, "Surely not." So, he says, "No." Okay. So the Buddha says, if you've never seen it in the past, and you haven't seen it, you're not seeing it now, would eye consciousness of this thing that you've never seen before arise? And the monk says, "No." You know. And then he says, "If in the future you never saw that, would eye consciousness arise of that particular thing?" And the monk says, "No." So then the Buddha says, "Well, and he goes through the same thing again, but he says, if eye consciousness didn't arise, would your mind become, would desire or passion or excitement or indulgence or agitation arise?" And the monk says, "Well, no. Right? Because there's nothing arising to excite the mind, to indulge in the mind, what have you." So the Buddha goes through each one of the sense doors with that litany, okay? Just to make the point that if there's no contact, okay, doesn't come up. And then he talks about watching for this particular moment. So then he says these lines that are very similar to what the monk says. And he says, in regard to all things that are seen, heard, sensed, cognized, each one of the sense stories, in what is seen, there is only what is seen. This is how to practice. In what is heard, there is only what is heard. This is the way to practice. In what is sensed, there is only what is sensed. This is the way to practice. In what is cognized or recognized intellectually, there is only what is cognized or recognized intellectually. This is the way to practice. And so then he says, "Well, what happens if you actually practice that way? You know, if you could actually, when you hear something, that you just stay with that, you know, and your mind has an urge to go someplace else, but you just stay with what is heard, what would happen?" And he says, "Well, two things would happen." He said, "The first thing is your mind would not become agitated or excited. If you just stayed with the raw experience of the hearing or seeing, it's not pulled off into the stages of dependent origination, you know, desire, aversion, attachment, identification. You stay all the way back at this original moment of experience, of original consciousness, that would not arise. And the second thing is that the hindrances would not arise. All of the hindrances, desire, aversion, sloth, torpor, anxiety, restlessness, doubt, wouldn't arise if you just stay with the raw experience. And he said, well, what happens if you don't do that? He said, well, what happens? Everything proliferates. You know, thought comes up, you follow the thought. Desire comes up, you follow the desire. And it proliferates into attachment or identification, and then you're just operating on automatic behavior of thought, basically. So he said the entire basis for not identifying, you know, the whole I, me, my, the whole drama of that, if we could actually do this, if we could begin to see the difference between the canvas and what arises on the canvas, stay with the raw experience, don't follow all the rest, our whole experience of identification would change and start to dissipate and eventually disappear. So that's the sutta. So the second one, and I'm going to put these two together. The second one is the tortoise sutta, and it's a little shorter, a little simpler. Okay. And so the tortoise sutta is that a tortoise is out on the side of a lake, and he's foraging, you know, for food, not very quickly, but he's enjoying it. And so he's out there looking around, and he's got his neck out, and he looks over, and he sees this jackal on the other side of the lake. And it's like, oh, man, okay, that's not good. And he kind of does this calculation and realizes that even if he does his version of running, he will never get in the water by the time the jackal comes over to check him out. Okay? So, you know, does anybody have any idea what he does? Okay, you know, he pulls his legs in and then he pulls his head in and the jackal comes up and, of course, knows that he's in there. Right? And the jackal just keeps hanging around and sniffing him and putting his paw on the top of him. You know, this goes on for quite a while. And then pretty soon, you know, the jackal concludes that, you know, nothing's going to happen. And so he gets bored and he leaves. Okay? So the Buddha says that what this story is about is that, you know, the turtle in the legs and the arms are the sense doors. Mm-hmm. And it's about a frequently discussed thing by the Buddha of protecting your sense doors. Okay, so like if I don't expose my sense door, my arm, or to whatever it is, all the way or in a particular way, that this whole chain of events doesn't arise, or it is lessened. You know, where this moment of contact and the proliferation doesn't happen because I am protecting my sense doors. So the Buddha then says, well, what happens if you don't protect your sense doors? And he says, well, basically he says you're in trouble. Okay. And he goes through each one of the senses. And on each one of them, he says, what will happen is that you will expose yourself to unskillful qualities in the mind. And he lists them off, you know, greed, desire, all the hindrances. And you will expose yourself to all of the hindrances. So that the lack of restraint, and first of all, you have to have the knowledge, right, about what causes your mind to proliferate, what causes your mind to go into reactivity. And so then protecting yourself against that, exposing yourself. He says, well, what happens if you do exercise diligence in protecting your sense doors? And then, of course, the answer is just the reverse. He says, if you properly do that, You're aware of the risks that you're facing from your own mind, that you know how to protect yourself from them, that you point your mind towards wholesome qualities rather than unskillful qualities. So you can hear, hopefully, the relationship between these two suttas. You know, that there's consciousness arises in a certain way. It arises where? From a sense door. And then the second one is saying, okay, it arises. And the second one says, there are different qualities of mind that immediately arise after that moment of consciousness. And what we do with that is critical. Okay? So just in a very general sense, I mean, like, what would this mean? What would it mean to protect your sense doors? So the first thing that is probably the most common thing that's talked about is all of us, I think, have heard the term, you know, mental formations. It's referred to in a number of different ways. To make it simple, we talk about deep habits of mind or reactivity. And we know that we get lit up, all right? We become reactive, and that many of these are based on our prior history, you know, experiences that we've had, people that we've encountered, what have you. And, you know, last time I did that little exercise where had everybody close their eyes, and then I just would say one word, you know, homelessness, and I said Donald Trump, and, you know, there were quite a few reactions in the room. I saw, by the way, today, I don't know if you saw it in the Wall Street Journal, the headline was from his talk, "I'm not going to blow it." So that was encouraging. It's great to hear somebody running for president to say that. So, but I mean, it's like the simplest thing that, you know, like we try to make this like really profound and then get lost in it. And the thing about the Buddhist teachings, they're just all about like, let's get real. You know, like you see somebody you don't like, what happens? You know, like you start going to the other side of the room or the other side of the street, and like rather than being conscious about it, you know, you just like get lost in that. So the first thing is, you know, being aware of through practice of, you know, watching what comes up and seeing how your mind is reactive and what are the patterns in your mind, what triggers your mind in meditation and daily life, family life. And so then, what does protecting your sense doors in relationship to that mean? Well, it always fascinates me is that around the holidays, okay, Thanksgiving and Christmas, I always get these calls from people, and normally they don't come and talk to me, you know, like practice interviews, but they want to come and talk to me. And almost invariably, what it's about is, I'm going to go home for the holidays, and every time I go home, I get triggered, you know, and everything, you know. And then so you just, you know, I just try to work through, okay, well, why do you get triggered? And you know, we have the idea, you know, what happens when we get triggered, and particularly if we have something that we were kind of holding in our mind that's traumatic? You know, it's like our thinking just gets really fuzzy. Everything becomes unclear, right? You know? So it's like, Well, what triggers you when you go home? You know, I mean, is it the sight of somebody, or is it that every time you go home, like one of my really good friends, they're very clear about it. When they go home, everything's great until the older sister goes into this one topic, which she always does. And then everything falls apart. You know, like, I can't handle it, you know. So let's just take that as an illustration. I'm sure no one can relate to this. Such a unique phenomenon. But it's like, okay, well, let's look at it, you know. And there's many things, some things we can't identify because our mind's so agitated about them, the way they're holding them. But like on that one, you know, we talked about it, and I just started saying to her, okay, well, can you just go in the other room? You know, you don't have to get in her face. You don't have to tell her to stop it. You don't have to do it. Can you just in some polite way exit yourself from that discussion? Is that a possible strategy? You know, so we kind of talked that through, you know. And And then, okay, well, what's the next level? Okay, so you exit the room twice, and you come back the third time, and, you know, she catches you off guard, and there's the topic. You know, well, what do you do then? You know, I mean, is it possible that you could just say, you know, every holiday when you, I'm not criticizing you, but every holiday we get to this topic, and it really lights me up. You know, it really upsets me. And is there something we can do with that? I mean, like, would you agree, be willing not to raise that topic? I said, is that possible? You know? And it was like, wow, that's scary. Right? Because the dynamic is, for most of us in family history like this, is we just take it. Right? We just lay down. Okay? We empower ourselves to be powerless. So we talked about a number of things, and she went home for the holidays and then came back right after the holidays and was like, okay, what happened? And she said, well, actually, it went pretty good. And there were three times where I just went in the other room or I went outside for a walk. It was great. You know, everybody else got upset, but I didn't. You know? And she said the last time she brought it up at the dinner table, so there was no way I could get up and walk out. And so I said, well, what'd you do? He said, I said to her, you know, every year this topic gets up, comes up, and every year I really get upset. And I'm not saying it's anybody's fault. I just want to let you know that. And it really makes me suffer. And is there, could we agree at the dinner table tonight not to do that? And she said, my sister was absolutely shocked and couldn't believe that her raising that topic was in any way upsetting me. And she says, you just immediately stopped it. Now, my guess is that maybe that doesn't happen that often. But, you know, so it's like protecting your sense doors has something to do with taking care of yourself. You know, understanding how you get triggered, whether it's something exterior or something interior. So let's say it's interior, and that I know that when I think about certain thoughts, certain topics, that if I don't catch those, they're going to proliferate, and then I go into this kind of spiral. So then what do I do with that? Well, for many of us, the same thing happens. You know, we're kind of frightened of that. It's so frequent that when it does happen, it just takes us over. And we almost have this sense that we don't have any power over it, or it's so difficult, there's nothing we can do about it, you know? And so the advice here is, well, watch for that to come up. And as early as you can catch it, watch the moment that it's arising, because it's arising moment after moment. You know, it doesn't arise and then it's permanent. And it doesn't arise and it's there for an hour and a half or 2 hours unless we let it go. Mm-hmm. So practicing, and remember that in any given moment, no matter how bad it is, if I can just bring it down to hearing, seeing, feeling, sensing, touching, and for some period of time, and frequently it's not a long time, just staying right there, you can break the momentum of that thought pattern or emotion. Now, this is not what we've been taught to do. And it's not easy until we start practicing with it and developing a habit. But this is what practice is about. You know, I mean, the Buddha is really clear that this was not easy. You know, there's all the stuff about, you know, we're always swimming upstream against society. And just this little illustration right here about this thinking, this is definitely swimming upstream for most people. But once you start to do it, it gets easier and easier, and it all goes back to this, hearing, seeing, feeling, touching, what have you, okay? So protecting your sense doors would be first about your own internal habits. It could be about other people that you know it's just not healthy to be around. And it doesn't necessarily mean you will never be around them, but there are certain people that for almost all of us, are toxic. Or being around them, we just fall into bad habits, bad states of mind. So protecting your sense of doors would be not hanging out with those people or avoiding those people. And then when your mind gets stronger and you think that maybe you can be with that, and you know, then you try that. But once again, it's a recognition of, well, what is my capacity? So, you know, we talk so much about mindfulness. It's about, well, if you're mindful, everything's okay. Well, you can see from this that that's not it at all. Mindfulness is just seeing clearly. Okay, well, what do I do to maintain it? Okay, what do I do when I see that something's arising that's really toxic? Well, I'm mindful of it. Okay, I'll just be mindful of going into terror. Wow, that worked. You know, no, there's this whole skill set, and this protecting your sense doors in different ways is critical and at the core of practice. You know, and it's on retreat. This is one place where you get to work on this because you start to see it very clearly. You know, where in daily life, frequently it's hard to see. You go on retreat, once your mind starts to get a little boy, you see it, you know, frequently up in the air. So, so if we don't do this, what happens is all these things that we're very familiar with, our thinking starts to proliferate, right? This kinetic cycle starts of emotion, thought, muscular tension, and it just starts a kinetic cycle, and once it starts to go, it's really hard to break. And once that gets a hold of us, you know, once we start to attach and identify, we start misperceiving, you know, misreading, misinterpreting, and then making bad judgments, in the sense that we just fall into perpetuating old habits that point our mind in the wrong direction. You know, they don't take us out of our suffering. Okay? All right. So let's try to apply this directly, and this is this little essay on pain. Okay? So down at the bottom, this little chart, we know that this moment of contact that we're talking about, this original moment, that something happens there. And what happens is that with the consciousness is colored frequently. Three things come up, always come up, one of three things, with the consciousness itself, from a Buddhist perspective, psychology. Consciousness arises, I see, I hear, I feel, I think, and it's completely neutral. I'm just right there. The mind's in balance, nothing. Okay. Second thing that happens is consciousness arises, I see something, and there's a feeling tone of pleasant to it. It's subtle, but it's the start of this chain, and pleasant frequently escalates into desire. Desire frequently escalates into attachment. Attachment escalates into identification. Third thing that can happen is consciousness arises and the feeling tone or color or whatever works for you just to get a hold of this, you know, is that the consciousness has a flavor to it of unpleasant. Once again, it's very subtle, but it has that. And then depending on the circumstances, whether we see it or not see it, whether we do something, that escalates up into aversion, and then to attachment that's based in aversion, and then identification that's based in aversion. Yeah. Is that working? Okay. So what this is this is my effort to kind of adapt this model to a pain strategy, these two suttas and that fundamental reality to a pain model. And so this is a progressive, kind of a progressive spectrum. You know, one way to think of all mind states is that they're spectrums. You know, there isn't just anger. There's a spectrum of anger. I mean, we can be angry that is just on the other side of really irritated. But now we're angry. Or we can be really, really angry and we're just this side of rage. Okay, so there's not just this one little thing. There's this bandwidth in our spectrum, okay? So beginning to be able to distinguish where we are on that is important. So here, we could have a sensation in the body that is neutral. And, you know, you can have, you know, like, depending on how your body's feeling tonight, you know, and how tired you are, and if it, you know, you can take one hand and put it on the other and actually apply, you know, a fair amount of pressure. And it's not unpleasant. You know, you're just there having that experience, okay? So there are some experiences, even fairly strong sensory experiences, that the mind can relate to as being neutral in nature, okay? In that moment, you know, in every moment, it's arising again, right, and changing. In a moment, we know the sensation can go from, well, that's not too bad, to your mind freaks out over it, right? Just boom, you know? That's part. A perfect illustration of the teachings. In every moment, there is this possibility of what happens, and something can go from 0 to 100. You know, it takes cars. They said the new Tesla. It's completely electric. This big sedan, and it can go from something like 0 to 60 or 0 to 80 in 3.2 seconds.
And you can't hear it.
Yeah. It's a big car, right? You know, so well here, it's a millionth of a second. You know, it's a moment of consciousness. So then the next kind of, so there's a spectrum, and then the next spectrum up is that it can be unpleasant. And there's this range or a spectrum of unpleasant. It could then move up into being uncomfortable. You know, something can be unpleasant. We know it's unpleasant, but I'm not uncomfortable with it. I'm just having this unpleasant sensation, but it's not making me uncomfortable. I don't have to do anything about it. Okay, and we move into it being uncomfortable, which is this. The mind doesn't like to do this. It wants to do something to get rid of it, and then that's a spectrum, and then it moves up into something that the mind would identify as painful, and then painful has a range. So normally we think of you know, you go in and you know, I've had all these surgeries in the last 3 years. And I kind of feel like I'm getting to be a surgery pro. I went in for this abdominal surgery recently, and all the nurses and the doctor and the anesthesiologist, everybody would come in and start talking to me, and I'm not making this up, that they would all talk to me, and then they would stop, and they'd go, "You certainly seem awfully relaxed," you know. But I think I've gotten to the stage, and then working with pain, that I'm just not afraid. You know, I feel like, well, my mind knows what to do with this, you know. So normally, you know, they come in, and the first thing they ask you is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? And, you know, the assumption is that you are in pain. And so right off the bat, your mind is directed towards this idea. And so what this is a completely different thing. It's like, no, let's do a Buddhist investigatory approach of our own body and the sensation in our body, and well, what is in this particular, maybe I have pain all day long, but in this moment right now, when the pain's in my right heel normally, and I put my attention there, what's going on? Is it painful? Or maybe I'm not feeling anything in that moment. Or maybe it's just unpleasant. Or maybe it's uncomfortable, but not painful. And that deconstructive strategy is, as we all know, at the core of Buddhist practice, right? And the reason it is being able to see the difference, between consciousness and what's arising in consciousness, and the different things that are arising in consciousness. So rather than the mind, as I say, or adding something on, you know, like I go to my, I put my attention in my right heel, and rather than just being in feeling, just the feeling of what's there, just thinking of going to this area, my mind starts projecting that it must be painful. Because this is where I always, or a fear arises but by just paying attention to that, or I get anxious or whatever it may be. You know, anybody who has chronic pain knows about all of this. Okay, so this ability just to go down to the sensory level potentially cuts off just exactly what's in the sutta, this proliferation. It cuts off the beginning and the progression of the hindrances. So, in the three paragraphs, I start off by, you know, rather than just being what is seen or heard, we're adding something on. That if we're not doing that, our mind can be present and deconstruct the experience. Because once our mind goes into attachment, identification, it's actually functioning differently than when our mind is just mindful. Right? I mean, the mind has begun this process of agitation and excitement. And depending on how strong it is, you know, the whole activity moves from, you know, your frontal lobes back to your reptilian emotional brain. You know, that's what going on automatic pilot is. You know, the mind is reverting to these automatic self-protective mechanisms. So to the degree that we can be just with the seeing, hearing, feeling, touching, seeing, smelling, and then keep deconstructing it, and as I say in the third paragraph, just one quality at a time, just stay there, we can suddenly have a chance of seeing, is this sensation in my body neutral, unpleasant, uncomfortable, or painful? And those classifications make all the difference in the world of how we're relating to it and how we understand it. I mean, once the mind begins to understand that what I habitually classify as painful, and I'm afraid of pain and I don't like it, And that what that actually is a habitual response rather than the sensation itself. And I can start to experience that sensation. It changes my entire relationship to pain. So like, you know, I've had two knee surgeries in the last 3 years. And, you know, they're considered to be one of the most painful post-surgical things because, you know, it's carpentry, right? You know, I mean, they go and they cut off the top of your femur and, you know, they cut off the top of your other and they're gluing all this stuff on and putting pegs in there and gluing you back together. And then because most people wait quite a while before they get their surgery, that's what I did, you know, all your tendons, the length of your tendons changed. So the first thing that they want to do is lengthen all your tendons out, you know, and lengthen all this, it is painful, you know. But like with this approach right here, you know, like you're in there, they're stretching you out, you're stretching yourself out, and you just stay in your body. You know, like what, no, I'm not gonna go there. What actually am I feeling right now? What am I feeling now? What am I feeling now? But completely changed my entire experience of this rehab stuff, you know. And you probably know that the standard, not just for the surgery, but for rehab, is they want to keep you on these opioids because the rehab is really painful. So, I took none of that stuff, and I go in, and the physical therapist kept wanting me to take opioids before I came in for the physical therapy sessions. I mean, like actually encouraging me to do that, and I kept saying, why do you want me to do that? You know, do I act like I'm really suffering? Am I acting like I'm in a lot of pain? And, you know, finally they said, well, actually, no, you're not acting that way. So, and most of this, most of these things, I would not characterize as seriously painful. I mean, it's really uncomfortable, and frequently it would bounce up, you know, during a session to painful. But it would just be painful, like if at an extension, right? So rather than the mind going, oh my God, you know that, and so the mind's actually thinking that from, you know, a 90-degree angle to a straight angle, that whole thing is terribly painful. You know, you suddenly start to see that, well, no, this is pretty uncomfortable, but the only time it's really painful, like when your mind wants to check out, is maybe the last 10 degrees. I can do 10 degrees. You know, that whole thing, maybe not. Maybe I can't hold out that. So, completely changes how you're relating to the sensation in your body. So, for me, this is one way that the suttas become completely practical, and that's what the Buddha meant them to be. And I encourage you to try this. You know, maybe it works for you, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're ready to try to practice that way. Maybe you will be in a couple of years. Maybe never, you know. But it's worth a try, because I think you can hear in this that it holds the possibility of significantly changing our life experience. And then when your mind starts realizing this, it starts relating to pain in your body and then pain in your mind in a different way. So and that's the thing about practice. Once you get a little bit of a foothold, it starts to become global. That's the radical thing about this practice and kind of the magical thing, because you're dealing with the fundamental functions of the brain. So once the brain and the mind wakes up to the fact that it's doing this thing that is not real, and that it's dysfunctional, and it's causing suffering, and the mind realizes that, and you can start to practice, then it starts to see that in many different places in your life. So it becomes very, very exciting. Much to my surprise and probably yours, I actually have some extra time. So we've got a little bit of time if there's comments or questions or thoughts about this.
I just, in listening to you talk about the pain, the thing that I've noticed, because I've had a couple of real severe periods in the last couple of years with pain, and being able to actually accept the fact that what I'm experiencing is painful, and to notice what the mind is doing, there's a real experience about pain, and it can impact how your mind functions, and it can have an effect on your overall. You just learn about different mind states, but it's not the same mind state as the turning away from pain.
That's right.
And it really is very different. It's just the acceptance piece for me was enormous.
Yeah.
It's like you don't know how long it's going to last. There is a spectrum of it, even when it's pretty intense. But you learn a lot, and it is very, in some strange way, very empowering, because it doesn't. When you were talking about it, it doesn't scare you. You're not afraid like you were. I mean, it's been pretty amazing, because I realize, you know, there are a lot of people that are in pain all the time. I've been around those people who needed to take drugs all the time, who needed to do, you know, to do whatever they did to try to go away from it. And sometimes you just can't do anything. It's still painful. I would take drugs and they wouldn't work. But there's still a way to work, to be with it, that doesn't completely wipe out your mindfulness, and you don't have to turn into an automaton.
It depends on how serious it is.
Yeah.
You know, like John Travis, when, you know, he had this surgery that really went bad,
right.
And he had all this peritonitis and everything, and he said he got out to a place that he had never been before, and how long has this guy been practicing?
Right.
You know, I mean, he's got powerful practice. He said he was out beyond a place where he could hold his mindfulness. You know, so pain is, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, is exhausting.
It is exhausting.
You know, so having a reasonable expectation about what you're capable of is really important. You know, because you can stay with pain for a certain period of time and what have you, and then at some point, and this goes back to protecting the sense doors.
Right.
Okay, like you got to realize, like if I keep trying to be present, I can see that in the last 5 minutes, I'm expending more and more and more effort. And now what I'm starting to do is I'm going into bracing just to stay present. It's not skillful. Okay, so that so it's okay to check out in some way, you know, to protect myself. But I think at the core of practice, you know, we don't hear the word acceptance, frankly, that much. And I think it's fundamental, because if we're not willing to accept whatever it is, anxiety, fear, depression, physical pain, as a baseline, not that, you know, I'm giving into it, but I accept that, in fact, this is the reality in this moment or this minute of my life, that this is the truth of my life right now, mm-hmm. and that unless I'm willing to accept that truth, I can't stay present with it. All I can do is try to manage it and control it and tolerate it and all of this, okay? I can't actually be with it to understand it, to learn from it, you know, to expand my kind of my bandwidth of being able to be there. Yeah. So thank you. Yes.
I was in therapy today, and I was feeling pain, and then I got...
Physical pain?
Physical and emotional, okay. And I got expressed anger. So I don't know if that's healthy or not. Sometimes I feel I was in the right setting to express anger, because it was my therapist, but, you know, but it was like a release of some of the pain.
Sure.
But I want to know if that's healthy, because I still felt pain, but... Not as much. It just was like a. I don't know if that's healthy to do or not.
Yeah. Well, I think. I mean, we know from just like some of the simplest practice techniques that actually being able to name what we're experiencing, rather than being lost in it, is a very powerful thing, mm-hmm. and frequently can diminish the intensity of what we're experiencing. So, you know, I think as a basic idea, yeah, that it can be helpful, and in a therapeutic setting, it's completely appropriate. And then, you know, and then there's always the issue of just indulging in it. And actually, in that sutta, although I don't think I said it, the Buddha actually talks about indulging in something. You know, like, and I think we've all had this experience. You know, I mean, like, just kind of get lost in it, and you kind of get. It is an indulgence, you know. So that is a spectrum. Actually, for me, almost every question that asks in some way, there's a spectrum of understanding it, right? Because, like, well, we could say protecting my sense doors. Okay, well, the way I'm going to do it, I'm not going to leave the house. You know, I'm going to clamp down so hard that I don't give myself any opportunity to grow and to test out these teachings, you know. So all of it for us is like at our particular stage of life, of experience, of practice, finding how will these teachings work for us, you know. So.
Yeah. One of the attractions of the teaching for me, I always have had extreme emotions that I've had to learn to manage all of my life. So that's the pain that I've dealt with, and the best experience or the best way I can describe it, it's like an ocean. If you sit there, and the emotion will come, and sometimes I can stay present and strong in that emotion, and sometimes the waves take me out, depending on how traumatic the situation is. But what I always, learning to work with it and manage it, I would always say two things. I'm either the program or the programmer. And the programmer is the one that's able to look at it, to see it, and then to choose a reaction to it. Whereas the program is when I get caught up and back out into the waves. And so for me, it's, you know, staying present. And I also had learned a study that when you become emotionally neurologically, somebody might know this for sure, your amygdala hijacks all of the energy from your brain, from your frontal, you know, your executive function. So when you bring it to your senses, you're labeling it sense, hearing, et cetera. You're bringing it back to the frontal.
Both right.
Yeah, that's why we're so irrational when we're emotional. So another thing, when I get the strong power of emotion, I can just sit there and realize I'm not going to be thinking straight. Don't react.
Yeah.
Anything in this state of mind is going to create more of the same. Mm-hmm. If you want to continue to be angry, react, think, you know what I mean? Just let this emotion process through, you know, and that's kind of... Yeah, and so the Buddha, I guess, says the mastermind, and, you know, so when I heard his teaching, which was different language, but I understood and I relayed, I went, oh, I got to check this out.
Yeah,
yeah, that's it, yeah.
I've been working on a practice to try to protect my amygdala.
Mm.
If I haven't figured out to do it.
No.
Yeah, it's not working yet.
No, let me know if that happens. Yeah.
But the wave idea that I like is that, you know, I think one way to understand this practice is energetically. Mm-hmm. You know, that every single mind state has an energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And how we engage that energy is critical. So, you know, like if you watch surfers, and, you know, these waves come in, and depending on how close they are to the wave, you know, you're trying to time it right, and you get there and you go, oh man, you know, this thing is going to just take me out. And so, what you do is you actually dive into the wave and come out the other side, so that this force of the wave doesn't come down on you and crush you. And if you see people who are inexperienced, what do? You know, here comes this big wave, and it's like, I'm going to stand here, and it's not going to, you know, I'm going to see if it won't knock me over, right? And so, which is what we're frequently doing, right? It's like, you know, we're bracing, we're holding on, you know, we're trying to fend it off. And so all of these practices, are the vast majority of them, are like, how do I engage this in a way that it starts to diminish the power, the energetic power of these negative mind states, and bring my mind and my body back into balance, you know, ultimately. And so much of that is nonverbal, right? I mean, we're all using words, and we kind of get lost in thinking this is conceptual. It's a cognitive practice. It's cognitive in the sense of getting a hold of the theory, but then it's like, experientially, how do I do this, right? Yeah. So. Okay. So, what do you think? Oh, okay. One more quick one, or a comment.
I was just thinking sometimes if I can be mindful enough to do it with something like your analogy of the wave comes, if I can be mindful enough for a minute or two to just breathe.
That's right.
Before I try to even feel anything else about it.
That's right.
Then maybe I can feel it in a little more grounded way that lets me look at it instead of being something.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one way of understanding that sutta, right? It's like, you know, just feel the sensation of your breath. Just hear your breath. You know, right? Just that.
The moment in the shell before.
Yeah, and don't let your mind, once it's, you see it's going to go out, don't let it just stay right here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so thank you very much for coming. Yep, just 1 second. May all beings everywhere find some true measure of peace and be free from suffering. And, you know, just remember, we're all in this together. And so this thing about may all beings, it's really true. I mean, you know, like if all of us don't have some change in consciousness and experience, it's pretty unreasonable to think that the world is going to change. You know, so thank you very much.